Hi, this is PV People. I'm Ben Figgis. Today I'm speaking with Raad Bekaerat. He's had many positions in the Middle East PV industry. He's really been a pioneer out here, especially in Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and now Jordan. Today we'll be talking about his time with KAUST. He really helped us set up some of the partnerships in the PV industry for that university. And then his time with First Solar in the Emirates, Nomad, and now his consulting work based out of Jordan. If you'd like to get in contact, you can send an email to contact@pvpeople.org. The interview was recorded in late May 2022. I'm actually looking at your LinkedIn page. You've got four positions at the moment.
You can call me a dedicated freelancer. So I support multiple entities concurrently. I mean, most of my time these days is going for EPCO, Alternative Energy Projects Company, which is a project developer out of Kuwait. But I also I'm an outside advisor with Apricom, and I still support the Clean Energy Business Council, Middle East Solar Industry Association, and so on.
Right. Well, I guess that makes sense. Like, the reason I wanted to interview you is because you know more about this industry in this region than anyone. So it kind of makes sense that you would be doing this consulting work for many different customers. You're like an elder statesman of the industry here. I don't know. Would you agree with that, or you describe it?
To a certain extent. I came back to the Middle East in 2009, and actually, I wasn't. When I came back in 2009, I was part of the economic development team at a big research institution, King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, KAUST at the time. It's interesting how it happened. I mean, I don't consider myself the expert in the energy transition in the region, but I've seen it vividly, you could say, from 2009 onwards. Because when I came back, I already had the notion. I've been tracking clean tech. I've been tracking renewable energy transition for years before that. It's something that I had, I think, in my heart and I believed in. I mean, I came to Saudi Arabia in April 2009. Months later, KKR was announced. And you remember their massive gigawatt announcement at the time of, I forgot what the figure
right.
was.
Now, yeah. Was KKR, that was the, was that also the nuclear? Part or not? Am I getting that mixed up with something else?
It's the same entity. It's King Abdullah City for Atomic and Renewable Energy. And it's mainly, right. I mean, the story goes, it was dedicated to support the energy transition in Saudi Arabia, with nuclear becoming a fundamental piece of that energy mix, if you will. But renewable as well was assigned to it.
Sure. So when you flew back to this region in 2009, like, describe the renewable energy landscape in the Arabian region when you got here.
If you go back to those days, the only countries that were actually beginning to make or take serious steps, I think those would be Jordan and Morocco. The GCC was still nascent. GCC was early on sort of thinking about the idea, but nothing much was happening. The UAE, of course, was an early mover in this space through Masdar. Mm-hmm. I remember the first system around the same time, actually, I should say. The United Arab Emirates, Masdar was installing their 10 megawatt, their famous 10 megawatt. I mean, Masdar was announced, and then Masdar had a solar PV plant that was a mix of polysilicon, I think it's Suntec, and 5 megawatts and 5 megawatts thin film from First Solar. Side by side, right there in Masdar City. Saudi Arabia, I mean, in the era of the late King Abdullah, were beginning to think about the economic value. I mean, it wasn't driven in those days by decarbonization. It was driven by more of the pure economics, which is still the case, but you have another element of decarbonization, carbon credits.
So even back in 2009, with the prices then, they were still looking at this for economic reasons rather than, let's say, environmental reasons. I wasn't aware of that, actually.
It goes both ways. If you go back to roughly 2009, when I came to Saudi Arabia, oil was around $120 a barrel. And there was a voice in the government saying, you know what, oil, if we export it $120 a barrel, it's much, much better value for us than keeping it for domestic use. And the idea it was really to reduce the burn rate. I mean, there was a word given by Ahmed Khouaitar, who's now the CTO of Saudi Aramco, calling it the burning platform. How do we reduce the burning platform, reduce the burn rate? To your point, Ben, on the economics of the GCC, because it's in the GCC, when the price of oil is high, then you hear the discussion within the government that we should reduce our burn rate on the internal consumption because that has better value economically, which is a valid statement. If you look at it from pure economic perspective, that drives the programs for renewable solar and wind, what have you, energy efficiency as well.
Sure.
But people think that when oil goes to 50, that the drive for renewables in the GCC in specific would be reduced. And this is not a true statement, because when the income is significantly reduced for the governments of the GCC, then the cost of subsidies become a bigger percentage of the fiscal plan of the government. Because the revenues are coming. Now it's half what it used to be at $100. Now it's 50. Mm. But I'm still burning the same internally, and my subsidy cost is suddenly a big percentage of my fiscal planning. And now they become even more aggressive to reduce the burn rate internally and so on. So when the oil is high, there's an argument for it to push solar and renewables. And when the oil is low, there is even a stronger argument because you have to reduce subsidies.
So tell me about your life over the next couple of years at Cal. So what did you do? What did you see?
To tell you the truth, it was a lifetime experience. I mean, here I am. I've always had an office in a factory. I have a PhD, but I'm a manufacturing guy. I'm a technology guy, and I'm being recruited by. It still is one of the top research institutions in the region, not just in Saudi Arabia, and everybody had I can say glitter in their eyes when it comes to solar. I mean, everybody had huge ambitions. I was amazed at the names and the size of the corporations, international companies running to engage with an institute like KAUS. Everybody telling me, we never had an opportunity like this. I mean, the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, same applies to other countries, Qatar as well. These are markets.
Now, in terms of foreign technology partners coming in, I think that Showa Shell, the CIGS company, they had some investment in Saudi. Is that right? And were there any others?
You're 100% correct. I was actually one of the things that I immediately noticed. King Abdulaziz City for Science and Technology, CACS, has done a CPV solar system, a very famous CPV system in the mid-70s, I believe, or early 80s. And it was a few hundred kilowatt, costed millions, and it was idle at the time, but that was pretty much the experience in the country. And I saw a need for an applied component that supports the kickoff of the solar market in Saudi Arabia. One of the basic problems that we saw is a need for an outdoor test field. And that whereby we can invite companies, because companies, there was a question about the adaptability of the technology under the severe weather conditions of the desert, which is a valid question even today. But that was the genesis. The genesis of that was what we did in the new energy oasis, NEO, which is really, I took a piece of land literally outside the research park at KAUS. The response I got from companies was amazing. I mean, I had companies lining up to set up a test bed, sizable, I'm talking 10, 20, 30 kilowatts of different technologies for free, just to be able to have access to real Saudi weather to show the performance of the technology, because they never had anything in the Middle East, let alone Saudi Arabia, to show that this technology actually works. So when it comes to bankability, in 2009, it was a huge deal for them to have say, you know what, I have a real system running at KAUS with real environmental conditions, and here is the data. Being part of the economic development team working with Saudi Aramco, had owned a share in Showa Shell. It happens that that company owned a thin film CIGS company, which became Solar Frontier later on. We visited them even in Japan. I went through their factories. It was very impressive. I mean, at the time there was the discussion, is thin-film going to be a winner? Is silicon going to be a winner? And Showa Shell was very keen to come to Saudi Arabia. We set up a test field. It was it was the first setup in the New Energy Oasis. It was 10 kilowatt thin film CIGS installation in the Middle East, probably. And after that, there were like another 10 companies, different companies. Interesting, Mia Soleil. I mean, some of the names haven't totally disappeared. It's just their product changed. But yeah. BP Solar, believe it or not, before the
exit. That was silicon.
And there was, I still have, I mean, Kao still has BP solar panels. There was a sulfur cell, an amorphous silicon company, Japanese. They don't longer make amorphous silicon.
Tanica,
the early version. I had the early, the micro layer.
There was Kyocera, I think, was also doing
Q-cells as well. I mean, a few of the early names at the time. I mean, those were the top names in 2009, 10.
What about, did you have First Solar there? So did you have CadTel there?
We had CadTel. We had First Solar. Yeah. It was around 2011, 2012. Yeah, 2011, 2012. We had a 3.5 kilowatt installation for First Solar, Series 2.
Nice.
Yes.
Now, the other thing that was going on around there was that the Mazda, the Emiratis, didn't they buy a German amorphous silicon factory?
Mazdar. They were called Mazdar GmbH.
But who did they? But they obviously renamed it Mazda. But what was it called before Mazda bought them?
Yeah.
And
it didn't last long at the time. I mean,
of course. I mean, amorphous, I think, was even on its way out in 2009. But
exactly. Even with Micromorph was 7-8% efficiency and was pretty much dying. Silicon was killing it, and thin-film was killing it. So. And you mentioned two examples that have set the policies from the public sector even to today. I mean, the experience of Mazdar with Mazdar GmbH and Qatar with Solar World. Now, nobody wants to invest in manufacturing, wants to put any money in that. Even Saudi Arabia, I mean, there was a lot of discussion and efforts even led by, you know, entities like PIF, Public Investment Fund. Couldn't materialize a proper PV manufacturing at the right scale in Saudi Arabia.
So tell me how you got to First Solar.
I mean, at the time, there were delays in setting up the solar center at Kaust for various reasons. And to be honest with you, I mean, my engagement with the private sector, I mean, resonated to me. I mean, I'm a private sector guy. I'm not really academia. And out of the blue, really. I mean, First Solar approached me and said, hey, would you like to come and lead our efforts doing project development, business development in the Middle East out of Dubai? And I made the move. That was in June, July 2013, actually. I left Kaust and moved to join First Solar. So at the time, First Solar already had started the 13 megawatt project in Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Solar Park under DIWA, but I was part of it when it was being executed. But yes, that was 13 megawatt, 1-to-1 DC-AC ratio. That was the first project for the what is now today the 5 gigawatt. It's amazing, huh? Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Solar.
Right.
They started with thin film. They started with 13, because thin film has all the attributes of the lower temperature coefficient, power temperature coefficient, and the higher gain in hot desert climates and so on. And yes, that came online, I believe, end of 2013. And shortly after, DIWA announced phase two of Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Solar Park, which was a 200 megawatt AC, 260 megawatt plant, thin film. It was First Solar as well. And there we didn't finish the developer, but Aqua won that. And that was the first project that was sub 6 cents from a tariff standpoint and made headlines around the world. That's when the region started making headlines in terms of breaking records on tariffs and project sizes.
Okay, so there you were just a module supplier to Aqua, who was the developer. Right. But I think, you know, First Solar did have some problems with cracking. Was this seen in the Emirates, or wasn't an issue there?
I mean, every module supplier has their issues, and during, you know, that comes down to packaging or manufacturing quality. I mean, First Solar had a recall, a serious recall around that time. But First Solar was able to stand up and manage all the warranties. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting. One of the changes that were introduced in the manufacturing process that was probably introduced maybe a bit too quickly. And by the time the impact of that change on field performance was seen, they had megawatts all over the world that they had to recall. But it wasn't an issue in the 13 megawatt. I mean, 13 megawatt, that was not part of that recall. I mean, we had other issues related to snail trails and packaging that were immediately resolved.
So the 200 megawatts went in at less than 6 cents a kilowatt hour. What were the sort of like the lessons learned? What went well, can you say, with those projects? What would you have done differently?
Sure. I mean, the main thing that comes to mind is the over-engineering that was done by the EPC, by First Solar, and the over-engineering that's expected by the off-taker. I mean, when you talk to the guys in DEWA, to be honest with you, I mean, just to hear comments like, will this actually work? Literally. And I'm an engineer, right? And I used to look at the designs and even go to my folks at the time at First Solar and I say, guys, I think this is an overkill a little bit. But they were like, no, we have to do it this way and no other way and all that. I'm talking about things like piling over 2 meters in rocky land in Jordan or these massive foundations for inverter houses. It's like a villa, you know what I mean?
But right, I mean, right.
One of the issues that I think the inverters were suffering from in the early days of DEWA 13, the temperature was too cold. I mean, the HVAC system sitting on the house. But there was over-engineering. It was accepted. People were worried. I mean, again, maybe that was the right way to go. We don't want any failures that, you know, can derail the whole deployment of technology. The second point was the issue of dust. I mean, at the time, there were people literally standing up in events and conferences and saying solar will never work in the Middle East. We are a desert country and sand will just kill the performance. And we managed to show the DEWA 13 is the first project in the Middle East that was able to demonstrate you can maintain clean energy without using a drop of water for cleaning. And the only water used on that site until today, believe it or not, is only for the bathroom. Whenever somebody uses the bathroom, that's about it. Sanitary. Seriously. And nothing for cleaning. The plant was washed once during commissioning to do PR test, and that was it. Done. Right. Dry cleaning till today.
Right. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys developed your own brush, which was pushed along by workers. So a couple of workers could be very efficient. A couple of workers could push along and clean a lot of modules very quickly.
That's exactly right. And they're still using it till today, by the way, as far as I know. I mean, there were no sticks at the time. There were early days of Solbright, I think. But there was nothing really bankable. And there was a notion that you have to create jobs during O&M. And First of all, they developed their own tool. It's a very simple tool. It's spring-loaded. The brush segments that were tested to the modules. The modules at the time, they had no arc. I mean, Solar introduced, First Solar introduced coatings, I think, series 4 or series 6 even. I mean, all the previous ones had no coating whatsoever on them. So it was easier for First Solar to qualify a brush, a bristle, that would not have a negative impact on the modules. And we were maintaining on average below 3% average soiling loss. I mean, there was a lot of learning curves on that plant. I mean, cleaning, we managed to show that you can do dry cleaning. You can do an average soiling loss of below 3%. Another huge lessons that came out when it comes to soiling in that plant, the do-nothing case of soiling for DEWA 13, which is 13 megawatts sitting in, you know, 50 kilometers roughly from the shore in Dubai, the do-nothing case from an average soiling loss for that plant is under 10%. And when you're I say kidding. This number, people say you're crazy. That no way. It's if you do nothing, it has to be like 30% of the energy. But it's actually we tested actual measurements under 10%, and the reason is humidity.
You mean the humidity is very low, or you mean the humidity is very high?
Water forming on the panels at night. The dew point, the formation of water at night, because you're in the desert, right? And these are glass modules. And but we had 20 plus events in 2013 or 2014, where we counted soiling loss value would be above 10% the night before. And in the morning, it drops to 1%. And we thought somebody just...
So you're saying that there would be a lot of condensation at night, and this condensation would clean the modules.
And that happens not once, twice. It happens more than 12 times each year.
And I'm so glad you mentioned that. And it's funny because, you know, I mean, I'm in the middle of this. I've done some research on condensation. And you're right, you don't know whether it's a good thing because it cleans your modules, like you just said, or it's a bad thing because the humidity makes your dust stick and then you get cementation. So it really is like, is it because it's really not obvious if it's good or bad? When is it good? When is it bad? It's a very rich and interesting topic, actually.
Sure. No, it is. It is. And you're right. I mean, there are details and nuances around it. But if you take a clear, quiet summer night in August, it's actually a good thing because the wind is not blowing and it's a clear sky. There is no sandstorm, and you know the modules are just producing water all night long.
Amazing.
In the morning, it's spank clean.
Amazing. That's
big lessons for me. So the two main lessons from the early days of utility scale is the over engineering in those days, and the last point is the mitigation of dust mitigation, how it can be done.
Right. So what advice do you give to your customers now about soiling and cleaning?
It's a practical problem that has a practical solution. You have to understand the site. You have to have, I highly recommend if people can, especially in the utility scale project where there's a longer development cycle, to actually install a soiling station and be able to gather the data, study the weather conditions, study the impact of humidity and condensation on your panels, prevailing wind, and then evaluate solutions from fully manual, simple gadget to clean the panels, relying on local community if there is a drive for job creation, to a fully automated robotic solution, to a fully automated vehicle, tractor-type cleaning. The main thing that I advise developers and owners to put focus on, and believe it or not, some people still don't fully believe that, you have to be 100% dry for the life of the system. Some people tell me, right, no, you have to cost in a couple of wet cleanings each year, and that's not a true statement. If you do it right, as you know, you can do it dry if you increase your frequency of cleaning, but you need an automated solution. You can stay without the need to use water. And I think it's very important for our region because of the carbon footprint. It's a huge contradiction to use desalinated water or underground water to maintain clean energy. I mean, there are projects, I mentioned the 13 megawatt in Dubai demonstrating dry cleaning is possible. But then we saw that in a gigawatt scale in Abu Dhabi, in the first 1.1 project, it was the robotic cleaning. They had their issues, obviously, initially, but I think until today, you have a 1.1 plant in Abu Dhabi that's being maintained without the use of water, which is unbelievable.
Right,
there is no technology to produce power that doesn't need water like PV. Which is amazing.
Right. And so that's fully automated dry brushing robots on that 1.1 gigawatt project.
Exactly.
So it is interesting. You said that you wouldn't necessarily just say there's one answer that suits everyone. So just to repeat what you kind of said, you're depending on your local market, your local conditions, your local labor force. You got to pick the right kind of cleaning solution for your plant. And that could be, as you say, anywhere between manual to truck mounted to automated.
Yeah, I don't think there is a one answer that fits all, and probably you would agree with that, Ben. I don't know. There has been a significant improvement in the reliability of the technology. I mean, the automated cleaning solution providers, they were in their, you know, they're not exactly garage shop companies like tracker companies used to be 10 years ago. I think they've made progress, but they continue to make more progress. I mean, this Intersolar in Munich, I was impressed to see even new names I didn't even know about. I think at some point, automated cleaning will be the norm, especially for large scale plants. And we're making our way slowly to that. Now, would that be a robot or some kind of a vehicle? You might have a mix of both. I was fortunate to be part of Nomad Saudi Arabia, which is a Saudi startup that came out of KAUST, actually, during my work at KAUST. Years later, after I left KAUST, I mean, Nomad managed to get Series A and begin to develop their products and stand their own two feet. I came back and I supported them for a couple of years. And one funny story on studying dust. You know, dust has different impact depending on the technology that you're looking at. If it's thin film, looking at the bandwidth of light you're blocking and the shape and size of dust and what have you. I had a test set up with the amorphous silicon. And I was measuring, you know, the performance of the plant. So I would clean it different cycles and squeaky clean. And then I would let the dust pile by itself naturally. And I made a presentation to the oil minister at the time. And I made a statement that dust helps the performance of PV panels in Saudi Arabia. And I was joking because actually, if you look at the initial, if you take a squeaky clean panel and you look at very fine dust beginning to pile on the surface, you get a slight boost in performance. I don't know if you've noticed that. There is a very slight boost. It lasts only for, you know, a few hours or a day or two.
I've heard about it. You're not the first person I've heard say that.
I've seen it. And then it obviously goes down very quickly from that. But I made a joke about it, and people took it seriously. And there was like headline, "Oh, dust is good for Saudi for PV panels." I'm like, guys, I didn't quite mean that, but I joked about it. So it was a nice boost actually initially. It was scattering. I guess there was an effect on the photons getting into the panel.
I guess. Well, one thing I'm sure about that I am 100% sure about is that a layer of dust is actually good for the module temperature because when your dust is very white, like it is here, it obviously reflects a lot of the of your sunlight away again. And actually, a dusty module runs cooler than a clean module I've seen here. So you get a fraction of your power back again, but only a fraction.
So people that are jumping on the podcast right now, listening to it, Ben and Ryan are saying this is good for PV panels.
Exactly. The one takeaway from this interview: dust is good for PV. Anyway,
there you go.
So Rudd, thank you so much for your time and the information and your stories. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise, Ben. Thank you for your time.